Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, David Palumbo-Liu will talk about the rights war and academic freedom, and then Jody Dean will sort out Trump for us. First, campus wars. Sometimes people on the left dismiss universities as bastions of privilege, irrelevant to the class war, which takes place at the point of production. But the right takes the academy very seriously, seeing it as an intolerable realm of freedom of thought where minds of the future are shaped in ways they don't like. Some of these battles have taken the form of attacks on various professors, George Ciccarello Marr, who was driven out of Drexel University, and Johnny Eric Williams of Trinity College, who has survived vicious attacks from people who wanted him fired. All have experienced death threats and other forms of harassment. David Palumbo-Liu, who teaches comparative literature at Stanford, is the latest high-profile target. Here he is to tell us why and why it matters. In the interview, Palumbo-Liu mentions Robert Spencer. For a moment, I thought he was misnaming Richard Spencer, the well-dressed neo-Nazi, but in fact, he was talking about the professional Islamophobe and David Horowitz sidekick who runs an odious website called Jihad Watch. All right, here's David Palumbo-Liu. Welcome, David. First of all, you teach, literature at Stanford, right?
Yeah, I'm a professor of comparative literature here at Stanford.
What's your specialty there?
Right now I'm working on human rights and global literature and things like that. I've been here for about 27 years now, for God's sake.
Wow. A real veteran.
Right.
You're under attack by the right. So what kind of things have you been saying lately that have exercised the right?
Well, the right is, you know, not big at Stanford, but it has a significant media organ in this thing called the Stanford Review. It was founded in 1987 by Peter Thiel. And the context for that appearance was right in the middle of the culture wars when we were debating multiculturalism, this and that. And I came to Stanford and was probably first brought on their radar because I work in ethnic and racial studies. And so that already had me in their bad category. And then I became very active with the BDS movement. And the first piece they did on me was actually called Stanford's Most Radical Professor Strikes Again. So it was a piece that they didn't even bother interviewing me on, but it was about Israel-Palestine, and it was a hit piece.
Let's pause for a moment there. Stanford doesn't strike me as an extraordinarily radical place. I've only visited, but what is the general political tenor on campus?
It's really apolitical. It really is embedded in Silicon Valley, and there's a kind of the overall climate here is let's do our business and not talk about things. You know, just do ordinary academic business. The Hoover Institute is here, of course. But for all the time I've been here, they've always been kept sort of at arm's length from the main university. They really are an ancillary unit that just is here as a legacy from Herbert Hoover. And so they've tried to make incursions into the main campus in terms of programming and whatnot. And actually, and this is something we could talk more about if you want later on, they've started what's called Cardinal Conversations, which is their version of managed free speech. They're bringing Charles Murray out. And unfortunately, the administration here has gone along with it. And so now Charles Murray is speaking at Stanford under the umbrella of free speech, but it's being housed at the Hoover. So it already moves it over into their terrain. So this is a troubling development.
Actually, of all things, you may not believe this, but I was a Hoover media fellow about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Because the person running it was a closet left-winger, and she brought in as many left-wingers as she could get away with. But as I recall, it was really lived in its own world. It was very well-resourced, but it was really very isolated from the rest of the campus. Is that's correct?
Absolutely. But recently, I would say about 5 years ago, you know, they've gone to various directors, and I was at one faculty senate meeting when the new Hoover director gave a presentation. He said, we'd really like to be the public policy wing of Stanford, and that sent shudders down many of our backs because, you know, that was a real intrusion into the university proper. The last big upset with the Hoover was when they tried to give Donald Rumsfeld an honorary degree or an honorary title. And we fought back against that. And it really helped, again, foreground the relationship was between the Hoover and the main campus. But now that, again, with these recent debates over free speech, they've sort of commandeered that space. And that's troubling.
Yeah, okay. And these cardinal events, what are these about?
Conversations. They basically are trying to say that we can have civil debates, but they're bringing Charles Murray in, and his interlocutor is a Hoover fellow, Francis Fukuyama.
Oh, my God.
I know, exactly. What kind of dialogue or, you know, at one point, I think on their website, and you can check it out on their website, they said, well, we hope to widen the debate. We might bring Ta-Nehisi Coates out. So I thought, you know, if that is one end of the spectrum, then we're already having problems. But I mean, ever since Trump's election, all these things have been renegotiated in some ways. And that's why what's happening to me is now taking place under a rather different climate than what we're used to at Stanford.
Now back to you. You're very vocal on BDS issues, right?
Right.
Did you attract like national attention from the Zionist operation for that?
Not more than usual. But what it did do was made me cautious about dealing with them. And so when they approached me recently about the Campus Anti-Fascist Network, which I helped establish, I said, well, there's already news stories out there in Inside Higher Education and other venues. And why don't you look at those first and then get back to me with some emailed questions? And I even said, Campus Reform, which is a right-wing college paper, did actually a fairly responsible job. And I said, that's closer to your ideological point of view. So look at theirs too. And the editor wrote me back and she said, thanks. I looked at the links. Here's a set of questions. And so we did everything over email. And nothing was done without being traceable. And they really pressed me on this issue of violence. Did I endorse it? What would I consider self-defense to be? And I was very explicit. And it was a very cordial, you know, back and forth, which was why it shocked me that when I clicked on the link that she gave me, the title is something like Antifa Thugs Find a Leader in Palumbo Liu. It was so off the scale. And the other thing that surprised me, which your listeners should know, which I haven't divulged yet, which is that, so she approached me and I figured that she'd get the byline, but the byline is shared with this person named John Rice Cameron. And he is a well-known college Republican. He's the person who brought Robert Spencer to the Stanford campus. He's also the son of Susan Rice. So there's a lot of other stuff going on here, but I didn't want to make it personal. I really wanted to, in moving this case out into the public, show the deviousness of the Stanford Review. And what I did in my response piece, which has now had like 3,000 likes on Facebook in Stanford alone, I think, was really say this is the way that the alt-right operates. They have this sort of stealth entree into your confidence, and then they will take everything that you give them and run it through their particular mill. And this is one of the points I really want to make in this broadcast, which is that it often begins this way. You'll see flyers on campus saying, yay, free markets, this or that from Turning Point. And it all seems innocuous and well within a kind of libertarian framework. But that's the way they get into campus. And then once they get a beachhead, so to speak, they will start doing things like sending people into classrooms, which is what they did at UC San Diego. Identity Europe sent people in and started taking notes on liberal professors. And then Turning Points has this professor's watch list. So it becomes very McCarthyite, very stealth, and then gets picked up by Fox News. I mean, they feed it into Fox News. They become a kind of conduit into the much broader national spectrum. And professors like myself have very little recourse when it gets up to that volume.
How did you answer those violence questions?
Well, I responded to them in terms of the first question, which is, does your organization associate itself with anti-violence? I said, no, we explicitly do not. However, we do feel that self-defense is legitimate. We don't believe in initiating violence, but in self-defense, it's appropriate to use whatever force is necessary. And she then pressed me on that and said, what do you mean by self-defense? Self-defense against what? And I used that to both talk about, you know, the kinds of things that went on in Charlottesville that Cornel West just talked a lot about, you know, that he and other clergy people were out singing This Little Lamp of Mine, and all of a sudden these white supremacists came at them with clubs, and he said if it wasn't for the Antifa activists, they would have been crushed like cockroaches. Also web harassment, you know, internet harassment, and things like that. So all those things, I think, are appropriate calls for defense that are commensurate with the attack.
From these kinds of answers, they transformed you into a thug, which, from what I know of you, seems like the most preposterous accusation.
I know. When you look at the Fox News segment, I must credit Fox for giving me a very nice photo. So I'm there in this suit and tie. So if that's what thugs look like, but we must be very, very stealth. But yes, and they also said, and the thing that was really quite inflammatory is that she wrote and then she repeated on Fox News that Campus Anti-Fascist Network has been deemed a terrorist organization by the FBI, which is patently untrue. In fact, I'm not sure that any anti-fascist organization has been labeled a terrorist organization by the Department of Homeland Security. What they have said is that various Antifa activities are labeled terrorist activities, but that's activities, not the organizations themselves. So they really are much more precise about what they are calling terrorists, not. But the Review and Fox and Friends were perfectly happy to take that ball and run with it.
Now, the Campus Anti-Fascist Network is pretty new, right? It was pretty hard for the government to have diagnosed the thing as a terrorist organization anyway. But
exactly.
But still, it's a preposterous claim. Like, tell us about the Campus Anti-Fascist Network. Who's founded it? You and Bill Mullen and a few others?
Yeah. Basically, almost immediately after, well, actually during the campaign, when we saw the way that the political speech was being taken into this whole new territory. It was quite frightening to us. And then as things developed, we began having conversations amongst ourselves about, well, you know, what are we going to do in terms of an organized resistance? And then there were more and more public incidents of professors in particular being targeted for speaking out against Trump or against any number of white supremacist organizations. And then Charlottesville happened. And by the time that Charlottesville happened, we already had a fairly close-knit group of about 12 people that were communicating regularly. We had started thinking about a website. And within, I would say, 72 hours of Charlottesville, we had a website up. And we were saying, you know, we have to, even although it's at the very beginning stages, we need to have our organization out in front as a place for people to go to for, if nothing else, informational resources and sharing strategies and things like that. So ever since Charlottesville, we've grown to have, I think, over 2,000 members by this point. We have about a dozen chapters in the U.S. We have people in the U.K. and in Germany communicating with us. So it's both U.S.-based, but also obviously has resonances outside the United States. But we're basically here to educate people as to what the history of anti-fascism is, and also updating people in terms of what the situation now is.
I'm speaking with David Palumbo Liu, a professor of comparative literature at Stanford, who's under attack by the right. It's important to point out that the right takes the campus very seriously, whether we're talking about the Koch brothers and their philanthropy and their attempts to create institutes and all kinds of things like that, often under the guise of diversity and free speech and all this kind of business. But also, you know, the more thuggish right is also takes the campus very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And some people on the left, you know, say, oh, the campus doesn't really matter that much. It's just a bunch of pointy heads. You know, there's a kind of anti-intellectualism among a certain kind of workerist left. But we should emphasize this really is a very important arena for the far right to act in.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes I hope that you do a show about what's happening at Arizona State, where the Koch brothers have set up this whole other school, and they're basically appointing faculty to it that are hardcore Chicago school economists, etc. And they're basically arguing that the School of Social Transformation has courses that are now extraneous or duplicate theirs. So there's a real battle going on about the curriculum. But you're right that the notion that the academy is sequestered away is really works against us in the sense that, for example, at Stanford, I teach a lot of first-generation students. People don't know this, but Stanford is almost majority minority at this point. And we have really smart activist students. This is a place where one of the few places in the United States where you do have some modicum of academic freedom, and we have resources. And so this is a battleground, and the right knows it. And the problem with the right is that they're not using it to debate ideas. They're coming here to put forward these theatrical claims to space, to harass people, and to move on. They really aren't invested in advancing knowledge. That's a sham argument. But college administrators fall into that trap because they're ill-equipped to deal with this new phenomenon. And this is why we're trying to educate administrators and others. This is a whole new battle.
Well, it also seems like a lot of college administrators are rather lacking in backbone. So if they get any kind of pressure, they fold rather quickly, don't they?
Exactly. They go to the nearest available exit, and it's always, well, free speech is for everybody, but this is really not a free speech issue at all.
Let's put these attacks on you in some context. There are several other professors around the country, Johnny Eric Williams, George Sikora Lamar, who've been under a very heavy attack, right? This is a very, I would say, concerted. I'm sure these people consult with each other, but it's also very broadly based attack on any professors who are seen as dangerously left of center.
Right. But what distinguishes my case, I must say, I think the other cases are egregious and patently so, but they're based on something that a professor has actually said that's been recontextualized, recoded, and distorted. I have said nothing that could possibly be construed to be saying what they depict me as saying. You understand? I've not talked about white genocide. I've not talked about let them die. I've never said anything that could be broad, that could be distorted, because all the things I've said have been in print, and I'm prepared to leak those emails. The evidence space is clear, but this is what the capacity of the right is to just put the label anti-fascist on it, and all of a sudden that's a bad thing. It's skewed toward a very recent phenomenon, and it really takes it out, extracts it from the long legacy of anti-fascist work, which is an honorable tradition.
But also, since you've been very vocal in BDS, that sets off a certain kind of, you know, Zionist who think that, you know, supporting BDS is almost an act of violence in itself.
Exactly. And one of the first things that happened when we announced the Campus Anti-Fascist Network is that Bill and I got slammed in the Zionist press as being sort of that the Campus Anti-Fascist Network was a stealth operation of BDS. And for people to think that critiquing the ethno-nationalism that's going on in Israel is separate from the critique of ethno-nationalism as a fascistic manifestation is crazy. I mean, they're of a piece. We're perfectly consistent, and yet, again, it's this way of ignoring the actualities and construing it in a very paranoid way that makes it somehow incompatible.
And now, of course, the figure of Peter Thiel is important here, and that kind of Silicon Valley libertarianism, which is falsely called such because it really is deeply authoritarian in its own way.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so Thiel founded this this publication, right, and funds it, and then there's this whole network around him as well, right?
Right, right. There's a very good investigative piece in, and you can find it online in Stanford Politics is the name of the venue, and this is a thoroughly investigated report that talks about dozens and dozens of ex-Stanford Review editors becoming part of an almost what I would call a kind of venture capitalist Stanford Review network in Silicon Valley, and these people are well placed, and they go to these regular dinners with Peter Thiel, and they exchange notes, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a very powerfully located and established network that's been going on for 30 years. So it is formidable, but what I'm trying to do at Stanford is to put in place, to begin with, just consciousness. I mean, what is actually going on? But also, we have something called the fundamental standard, which is very, very vague, but basically talks about, you know, we can't impugn the honor and dignity of fellow Stanford members. And people have been pressing me to use that. And I'm saying that as a last resort, I will. But I think more important would be to put in place something like, you know, a code of ethics for journalists to follow, that you can't make these irresponsible claims founded on nothing, especially in today's climate. As a tenured professor, I'm fairly protected. But if you think about undocumented students, which have been the target of when Robert Spencer came out, he outed various undocumented students. They got into private social media accounts. That's the kind of thing that we need to get administrators to recognize is the real harm and a real chill on free speech, because, you know, we have a petition going around Stanford campus. It has over 600 signatures, but supporting me and asking for some sort of policy that would regulate these kinds of behaviors. And I would say about a quarter of the people have chosen not to have their names used. And I'm going to talk to the administration and say, you know, what kind of campus do we want where half the people on campus nearly feel like they can't speak out?
And of course, you do have the protections of tenure, but there are a whole lot of younger faculty that could only dream
exactly.
of that, right?
So exactly.
They've got their eye on the long term. One of the things that's very impressive about the right is that they really do think for the long term. They really know what they're doing.
Yeah. If you look at, for example, in the UC system and Christopher Newfield's work on, you know, the way that they've got a public education. And he, you know, he places it really, again, like the discussion we've been having about Peter Thiel, around the culture wars. I mean, this is when things begin to solidify. And the real erosion of especially the public universities in California starts to take place. And yes, they do have a long game. And that's why we have to start getting ready now. But at the same time, we also have to similarly think of what kinds of institutions on campus, whether it be small or large, should we have in place so that we can build almost like a war of position within the university that will be there for progressive students. It's really important.
And this is, of course, what you're trying to do with the campus anti-fascist network.
That's precisely it, yeah.
And anything more local to Stanford that you've got going?
I think what's been really impressive has been the stamina of the students. And what we are really working on is faculty-student collaboration. Because when they voted, when the student government voted for divestment from companies doing business in the occupied territories, that was a coalition. The first time they tried it, which was 2 years prior, they lost. And in the 2 years, they really got their game together and brought in a wide coalition of students from across campus, and they won by a lopsided margin of victory. And the demonstration against Robert Spencer, again, was very, very well done. Again, the university allowed him on campus. He was brought in by the College Republicans, one of whom was the co-author of the hit piece on me. And the students basically occupied, you know, they went into the auditorium and they filled it and then they walked out in 20 minutes and he was left with 10 people there to talk to. And they took a before and after picture. It was quite well done. And there was a demonstration outside with about 1,000 people. At the demonstration outside, people were talking about tenants' rights, you know, gay rights, all sorts of other things. So there's a real potential there of collaboration between faculty and students. It has to be a collaborative effort because individually or in small groups, we really are easy picking.
And then finally, what can people not at Stanford or outside the academy do to help in this fight?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to learn more and really read widely. I mean, even places like the Washington Post recently did a piece that echoed what you said earlier, which is the right is really targeting college campuses. And so even the mainstream press is beginning to see this as a phenomenon that is important to note. And it's not casual. It's not ad hoc. It is programmed. And what's one of the things that's quite of concern is that these conservative groups are funding student government elections. So it's gotten to that degree of, you know, placing people inside. So first of all is to educate yourself. Second of all is to support organizations like the American Association of University Professors, American Civil Liberties Union, Campus Anti-Fascist Network. All these things are in place, are really good first steps. But most important is to really understand, and Melissa Figueroa and I did a piece in The Nation on this. This is not a free speech issue. We really have to make the pivot into the current situation and the way that it's being manipulated. And it's not about free speech or only about free speech in a very marginal way. They're using that as a foot in the door to get much more pernicious things onto campus.
That was David Palumbo Liu, a professor of comparative literature at Stanford. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of Brahms' Quintet for Piano and Strings, second movement, performed by the Amadeus Quartet with Christoph Eschenbach on piano. Next, by popular request, Jody Dean. Jody, a frequent Behind the News guest, teaches political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York. She's also a prolific author whose most recent book is Crowds and Party, published in 2016 by Verso. After Trump's State of the Union address the other night, the fiber optic networks were all lit up with a lot of bloviation trying to discern the meaning of Donald Trump. Most of it was not very helpful. What should we make of this guy? Worst thing ever, or just business as usual? What forces does he express and encourage? What does his presidency say about the state of the USA? No one is better equipped to answer those questions than Jody Dean, not only because of her expertise in political science, but also because she's such a skilled psychoanalyst of the public culture. Jody Dean. We're recording this the day after Trump's State of the Union, and of course everybody is reacting to Trump. Is he disgusting? Is he presidential? It's really hard to sort out how to think about this guy. He's been in office for a little over a year, and you know, we've got these twin polls where he is the worst thing ever, or he's just business as usual, maybe raised to a slightly higher level of intensity. Help us think about this. What's your evaluation? How much of a departure how alarmed should we be?
Trump, the personality, gets too much attention, right? That Trump, the personality, is like the lure or the thing that it's the distraction that takes us away from what's really a larger continuity. And you know, I think we can say the continuities with the Republicans. We can even say that the continuities also with the Democrats as well. And that this continuity is an embrace of American imperialism, an embrace of the politics of the ruling class, the corporate bourgeoisie, right, the 1%, and the continued embrace of a vision and practice of white supremacy. You know, I don't say this lightly, but let's think about just for a second, Trump's taking over the idea of the dream and the American dream from the dreamers, right? So the crucial rhetorical move when he's like, you know, American citizens can dream too, is an utterly anti-immigrant, racist attack on DACA and attack on those dreamers. So that was a clear rhetorical move. But what struck me was also the way that Trump's move there was exactly what Ta-Nehisi Coates has been talking about when he discusses the American dream and the dream in Between the World and Me, when he makes it really clear that this dream was a dream of whiteness and a particular kind of white life. He doesn't amplify capitalism as much as I think he should, but it's a white bourgeois life that's patriarchal, that has a particular kind of family, a particular version of achievement, particular version of what's possible. And that's what Trump gave us a vision of last night. And the other thing that sort of kills me about some of the, particularly the initial mainstream media response, is they think this is unifying and balanced. That's what should be super frightening, right? This vision of, oh yeah, a white America of citizens who are all one family. Like, that's the horrifying nationalist, jingoistic vision that that Trump promulgates, and that actually is shared by more of the ruling elite than they like to acknowledge.
You're going in a direction that represents a departure, but then also that kind of nativism, by citing Coates, but you know, by any citation of history, would say there's also some continuities there. So how do we sort that out? How much continuity and how much discontinuity is there in this this rhetoric?
I think it's a continuity, but I think his personality is the disruption, the discontinuity, but that's just a lure, right? Underneath, it's a continuous vision. I don't think it's disruptive at all. I think it's basically the same core dream of the capitalist elite that has been part of the United States forever, that you sometimes get pushback to, but that is, it's the Republican Party and way too much of the Democratic Party.
Silicon Valley wants Indian programmers, and the fast food industry wants Latino workers. So he's not necessarily doing the business of capital in this anti-immigrant rhetoric or these workplace raids or any of the stuff that ICE is up to now. So,
well, we can recognize, right, that the different factions of the capitalist class don't always agree, that some portion of the capitalist class, let's say particularly that occupied by the Koch brothers, relies on amplifying xenophobia and racism to get their particular version of tax breaks and corporate advantages secure. So I think that the fact that there's disagreement among the capitalist class doesn't speak against this general view.
But then you have, you know, Democrats, of course, in alarm that somehow this is an offense of everything good and decent in America, that, you know, we're a fundamentally decent nation and these are outrageous and stains upon this noble record. And, you know, more specifically, that this is you know, a departure from the Obama agenda, which is allegedly inclusive and humane.
Oh, God. So yeah, you can tell my response on that, right? I mean, Trump makes deportation into something that his followers can enjoy, right, in the sense that we've talked about in the past, right? This kind of enjoyment of hatred and their own kind of ability to push people out and assert themselves. But Obama was also increased deportations from those that were under the Bush administration. And deportations were part of his policy. Trump's militarism and imperialism were also things that were pursued by Obama and even more by Hillary Clinton. This vision of the Democrats as some kind of major oppositional force, or, you know, in their rhetoric, some kind of resistance, is like electoral politics game. I mean, there's more continuity here. I mean, also think like I've got to say, I hadn't been paying a lot of attention. And then when Trump was going on about, oh, and we have to modernize and update and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, then I looked that up. That had already started under Obama, too.
Yeah, he wanted to spend $1 trillion on the modernization, as they like to call it.
So where's the big difference there? I don't see it.
There is a big difference in style, though.
In the style. And I've got the thing that's challenging is that the elite loves Obama's style. And frankly, it seems like, I mean, I'm not among the elite, but I think a lot of us on the left also like Obama's style. What's not to like? But his style, too, covered over the fact that he had a, you know, a cabinet that was heavily influenced by Goldman Sachs. And Trump's a little worse on that score with his cabinet of the billionaires. But again, there's more continuity there than there is difference. You can think about Obama's drone war, another version of Trump's own wars in the Middle East.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, the Obama cabinet, you mentioned Goldman Sachs, but there's a, you know, it's a much more polished wing of the capitalist class. And Trump's base tends to be freebooting, freewheeling private equity guys and buyout artists and people like that. There's some differences, but, you know, they're just two wings of the same basic Wall Street structure.
Yeah, right. So we get the rough and ready crude part of Wall Street and then the polished Episcopalian part of Wall Street. And so we get a division among the capitalist class, their own, you know, intra-family squabbles. But the underlying thing is the same kind of the rich get richer, the poor get screwed. The middle class remains a myth that the elite appeals to hide the fact that they're making all the money themselves. Oh, I'm going to add one other thing. I'm going to change the course, if you don't mind, just a second. One of the things, of course, that was missing from Trump's speech is the fact of massive protests going on in the country. I mean, that's just sort of like this kind of vision of heteropatriarchal unity with the families he flashes to and the one gesture to a kind of social policy that women might like being the child care policy or child care leave. But for the most part, we saw a week or 2 weeks ago, hundreds of thousands of women in the street all over the country. We've seen this Me Too movement pushing back against sexual harassment in multiple different industries. And yet from the vision of America that Trump gave us, that doesn't appear at all.
he's an appropriate target for that kind of movement.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I just regret is that Stormy Daniels, you know, has gotten bogged down in this because she's got real work. And then she gets kind of stained by her association with this kind of cretin.
Trump has very low approval rating. The Congress has even lower approval ratings. But they've been able, despite, you know, the claims to the contrary, they've been able to accomplish a pretty odious agenda. despite this deep unpopularity. What does that say about the state of American democracy, that an agenda with so little popular support, like you know, the deregulation of finance, the elimination of environmental regulations, turning national monuments into uranium mines, all this sort of thing is deeply unpopular, but they're getting away with it. So what does that say about the state of our political system?
And so, like, this is what plutocracy looks like. The Democrats are utterly unable to, and not just unable, right? Unwilling to be a party of opposition, right? They screwed over the one person who opened up the possibility of an alternative politics, right? Obviously, I mean Bernie Sanders, because they want to maintain their corporate donations, their campaign contributions, and the, you know, the rule of the elite. So we don't have a democracy. That's really the case. And I think, as soon as liberal apologists start to acknowledge this and actually own their own rhetoric of authoritarianism and fascism, we're better off, because they're utterly incoherent. The way that they're constantly going, oh my God, he's an authoritarian, it's fascist, it's a decline of the world. And then they support mainstream Democrats? It's like, this doesn't add up.
Well, it's curious that they chose Kennedy to deliver the response. He's what, worth $20, $25 million, opposed to single payer, gets all this money from Bain Capital and Goldman Sachs. And he is now the voice of the official opposition.
Which is this, right? The sign that this is a war within the ruling class, one side of capital against the other side of capital, right? So we've got kind of the Bain Capital side against the wonders of clean coal and the energy sector that is now no longer under attack. I don't think they picked the wrong person. I think they picked the person who represents the party they are, the party of a familial elite, right? Inherited wealth, the party of dynasties. They wanted the Clintons to be that dynasty, and just like we can just keep our fingers crossed that that we can keep Chelsea Clinton out of politics for as long as possible.
Yes. I'm speaking with Jody Dean, a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Something that struck me about Trump, though, is so much of his rhetoric and policies, even, are very backward looking. You know, he's looking at coal. He wants to make America great again. Like, it's a journey to the past. He's not talking the way, you know, Bill Clinton was always talking about the bridge to the 21st century, the industries of the future. There's all that techno-optimism around Bill Clinton. You don't see any of that with Trump. And does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, that's super smart, Doug. I was starting to think a little bit about that this morning and noticing that there was no vision whatsoever of like even tomorrow, right? Everything was backward looking. And I think we see that really strongly with the utter omission of the fact of climate change, right? So there's these different weather disasters totally cut off from climate change, that there's this, you know, embrace of carbon-based fuels, no mind towards climate change. I thought that was really strong. And because he's not thinking about that's the world we're in, he doesn't have any capacity to think about how to address it. So that backward look, yeah, it strikes me as intentional too, because the vision of America he wants is this fantasy of a white world, right? Fantasy of a white world, white workers, one big white family.
Something that gets liberals exercised also is that Trump is ruining the U.S. standing in the world. He's just undermining our image. And I wouldn't want to get too carried away with celebrating the U.S. image abroad, but he does seem to be, in some ham-handed way, undermining some of the foundations of the American imperial structure by undermining NATO and like all these, saying, you know, we don't want to pay for all these countries' defenses anymore. They owe us money. You know, this imperial formula has worked pretty well for the United States for 70 years, and now he seems to be beating up on it. So does that matter?
One way I was wondering about this one is this undermining of the, let's say, the legitimation structures of U.S. imperialism, right? The treaty arrangements, the trade agreements, the money that we pour into various things, the at least a superficial level or appearance of respect. Is the undermining of those things, in fact, good, because it's kind of inverted acknowledgement of the fact that we are losing our place. Like, we're like, you know, Britain after World War II, that we're utterly a nation of decline. So it's a kind of covert or inverted acknowledgement of U.S. decline. Or is it something worse, a formulation where we've got all the guns and all the money, and so if we don't get what we want, we'll just kill you. And so I think the thing is, it could be the same thing at both times, right? Like, the country going down when it's nuclear is just going to be bad news.
Yeah, you know, Britain declined somewhat gracefully. I'm not sure the United States, you know, it's a much more unstable and volatile country, could decline with such grace.
Yeah, I think our decline is going to be bad news, right? It's like the bad uncle who's a drunk who just brings down all of Thanksgiving with him at the same time, pulling out all of the nasties and throwing everything and disrupting and destroying, you know, the whole household. I think that's probably what we're in for.
God. I wish the
so
bad,
this is really grim today, isn't it?
Yeah, I wish the bad drunk could just fall asleep on the couch and leave everyone else alone.
I think the whole world does.
Yes. Democrats, back to that grim topic. The Russia obsession, which has just gotten psychotic at this point. What do you think is driving that?
My initial thought was always that it was Hillary Clinton's failure to acknowledge their mistakes, and that just became an utter pathology of the Democratic Party, the failure to recognize that they had a terrible candidate, that she couldn't acknowledge the failures of her candidacy, and they just amplified that. But that seems a little bit too limited for an obsession that has gone on so long. And so it seems to me that it might be something more like, we can't blame our system for our problems of democracy. And so we're going to have to, you know, the fact that we're not democratic, the fact that democratic processes don't seem to be working the way that they should. And so we have to project the cause of all of that elsewhere. Like, so we solidify ourselves as a party and as a portion of, you know, a faction of the ruling class by projecting all of the problems onto an external cause. And Russia, for all of the most of the dominant part of the party's childhood, was the evil bad guy. It was the cause of the exterior position to American democracy. So it's available as that site for demonization. So that's the one thing that to me continues to make sense for it, right? Is they need to have an exterior cause. Just like the Republicans also have to have an exterior cause of all of the problems of the country. But for them, the exterior cause are, you know, black and brown people who live in, you know, want to live in this country, or who are always sources of violence and disruption.
Black people have been here a very long time, though. But I guess they've, you know, just never been fully Americanized.
Yeah. And but also, like, I'm thinking in part of Trump's claim. What did he call African whole countries or
yes,
something like
yes,
this?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that claim. And then the way that for Trump and other Republicans, Obama was never really understood as being American. So there's this way that Republican white supremacy works, is by treating all black people as never part of America, right? As this kind of other or whole, despite the fact that they built the country.
Another interesting aspect of the Russia obsession is that you know, they want to blame Trump on external forces, when in fact his kind of love of ignorance, his belligerence, his xenophobia, his white supremacy, his violence, all these things are deeply American. He's a huckster in the classic American fashion as well. Like, the idea that this guy came from another planet or something is bizarre.
Yeah, that's, again, it's like a failure to acknowledge what the culture is that we live in. So then we think, okay, so why is that? And maybe that's a sign of the fundamental division that actually Trump kind of embodies or signifies or amplifies, and that all of his voters recognize as well, right? There is a division in the country. And there's a division, it goes within the elites, and it's between the elites and sort of the working class, so the 99%. And it's always going to keep getting figured in different ways because we can't really fully express it. I mean, the way I think about it is the U.S. is in a civil war right now. And this civil war, like any civil war, is also a class war.
Could you say more about that?
Yes. Yeah, so on this point about civil war, one of the ways I think about it is, even the meaning of the problems, even the description of our basic society, even an account of what real news is or truth or issues, there's no agreement on that, right? There's not even a baseline of agreement. There's not a baseline of sources for resolving an agreement, right? This is, you know, the old postmodern expression would be the decline of meta-narratives, or the Zizek description is the collapse of symbolic efficiency. The way we can also say it is like there's no bottom line where people share an agreement, right? So the world of clean coal versus is not the same world inhabited by people who recognize climate change. It's fundamental. It goes all the way down. And this is an indication of the deep rupture, civil war in the country.
Yeah, and then there's also this fantasy among liberals that impeaching Trump or somehow having the FBI and or the CIA deliver us from him would make things better. But
oh my God, like we both remember the Nixon years and just the kind of inverted world where the CIA is the savior, or the FBI is the savior, is just so completely strange, right? It's like thinking about, you know, just imagine if we were Soviet citizens, like, oh, all of our hope is in the KGB. Oh, I guess they did sort of get that in a way with Putin, but there is something kind of really inverted about thinking that spies operating without any kind of political legitimacy are the ones who can save the republic. That makes no sense.
But I can imagine that, you know, they get rid of him. Suppose that happens. What then? I don't think anybody's got a plan for what then.
Honestly, do you really think that impeachment's an option? I guess I don't. I think that, I mean, they've got a majority in Congress. Are we thinking that impeachment is like going to be an election issue for 2018 and that should be one of the litmus tests for candidates?
Oh, I don't think impeachment's an option, but I suppose they're hoping that Mueller will come up with something that's so damning that he'll have to be resign or be driven out.
I even wonder, did you see that Saturday Night Live bit with Jessica Chastain? It was like, does it matter anymore, or does it even matter? And this is what I've thought about the Mueller investigation for quite a while, is that no matter what he discovers, there's not the political will or capacity to turn that discovery into an actionable outcome. I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, the kind of conflict of interest between Trump businesses and his position as president, between all of the different machinations of his children, the expenditures of his household, the being already so close to obstruction of justice with respect to the Mueller investigation, the fact of his infidelities and paying off in this environment of Me Too, all of these things in a normal world would have already led to an outcry large enough to bring someone down. But that will and capacity isn't present around him.
But to conclude on a somewhat more hopeful note.
Great. Okay. Good.
The Sanders campaign made it obvious that there's a constituency among young people for socialism or social democracy or something like that. And, you know, we see an awful lot of people under the age of 40 have a very different kind of politics or people over the age of 40. There was a lot of hope that was going to go somewhere. It's kind of a little hard now to recapture that sense of hope. But is there something we should remind ourselves there?
Oh, sure. I can do this part. But there's a lot of hope, Doug. First, let's go back to, again, the people on the streets, you know, last weekend, last Saturday, and these women marches. And I've got to say, you know, I live up here in Geneva, New York, and I went to the march in Seneca Falls. Seneca Falls is a town of like, I don't know, 6,000 or 8,000 people.
Of some historic significance.
It's some historic significance. And there were 15,000 people. It was insane. It was shocking. It was more than last year. And this was not just a crowd of pussy-hatted gray hairs, right? This was a more diverse crowd. There were a lot of young people. We were able to get them to join us in all sorts of much more radical chants than one would have expected. And they were into it. They were excited. You know, this is just one place. Like, there are other marches also that had a more, an exciting liveliness to them. I didn't expect it and was really relieved to see them there. And, you know, there's a lot of organizing going on right now for International Women's Day and a 1-hour strike all over for International Women's Day. Women are calling for a one-hour walkout and strike all over the world. New York's doing it, I think, from 4 to 5 or 5 to 6. Here in the Finger Lakes, we're doing it from 12 to 1. So I think that people are still excited. They're out on the streets. They're involved and engaged. Even if one is not optimistic about party politics, and I'm not, it still is good to see so many people engaged in trying to wage electoral challenges. And, you know, it's only going to be through those challenges that there's any hope of moving the parties. And even if that doesn't happen, then it can drive more and more people into a more radical left politics once they encounter the barriers that the mainstream parties represent. There's hope, and the hope is in the streets.
That was Jody Dean, a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York. Her most recent book is Crowds and Party, published in 2016 by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this. More Brahms performed the Amadeus Quartet with reinforcements. This is a bit of the second movement of his first sextet for strings. Till next week, bye.